Hello and welcome to our Game Week 3 episode for the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for joining us yet again. After a weekend where we finally saw every team in the Premier League post points on that table and a continuation of the 100% record for Manchester United, Manchester City and Chelsea, there is much to discuss as we head into the international break. In order to discuss all of these things, I am joined by the brilliant duo of Karthik Krishnayar and Chris Henoch. By the way, let me clarify something at this point. I have talked to Chris Henoch on this podcast or on other podcasts for about 3 years. It wasn't until earlier this week where I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, which is The Front Three, where I learned that I've been mispronouncing Chris's last name for the last 3 years. So Chris, is it Henoch or Henoch?
It's the second one, but I'm really not fussed. My mum used to prefer the first one because it sounded a bit posher.
Okay, in that case, we're sticking with Kristen Henoch, and I'll make sure I, you know, raise my eyebrow when I say it as well. So welcome, gentlemen. Let's get into the nitty gritty of this weekend. In part one, we'll split this up. We'll have more structure as we go along with the season, but for now, the table is pretty fluid. So we're just picking the games in their parts as we usually do in the order they were played, as well as we'll give you an update on the leagues around Europe as well. So let's start, Karthik, with the Tottenham-Liverpool game. A 1-1 draw, and Liverpool were dominant in the early portions of the game. And I guess what I want to start this conversation with is what Liverpool were able to do to Tottenham. And this is something that very few teams could do to Tottenham last season, Liverpool being actually one of them who did this to them last season as well, which is they were able to open up Tottenham's defense in those central midfield and central defensive areas. And I want to talk to you about that because it showed the brilliant attacking flair that Liverpool can have on their day.
Right, they can have it for 15, 20, 25, 30 minutes. They can never have it for a full game with the level, the intensity they play with, the kind of fitness levels that are required to play at that level. So I think once again, we saw a situation where they were very good for a period of time. I mean, just out of sight, off the charts, good for a period of time.
Yeah.
In a different way than a Barcelona or a Bayern, but similarly scary and dangerous if you're the opposition, like they were in from minutes 45 to about 65 against Arsenal. But they have to settle for a draw because you can't sustain that level of play. That having been said, they have 4 points from two trips to North London, and that's that may be more than anyone else gets this season.
Yeah, they definitely have a tough set of games, those first five games, and I think it's vintage Liverpool, Chris, that it's likely the game they'll drop the most points ends up being the last week's loss to Hull City, and they'll end up getting points on away trips and beating the likes of Arsenal.
Yeah, I think the Burnley game showed their inability maybe to dictate with the ball, and I think we talked about that last week. My concern for Liverpool, and it's something that I did kind of expect, was they have the likes of Coutinho, Firmino, these guys who can play through the lines a little bit and carry the ball. I'm not seeing much production from the likes of Wijnaldum, though, and Henderson. And I think Wijnaldum is the biggest culprit of this at the minute. And I've seen a fair few Liverpool fans voice these concerns. It's just his inability to impact the game in anything meaningful. Now, whenever I think of him, I think of him actually a lot more advanced than Klopp is playing him. So I'm surprised that he decided to invest £25 million in a player that really is going to be nullified by the position he's playing in at the minute. He's not going to be able to score goals. He's not really, I would say, much of a creator in that sense. He's not someone that will be able to break through a defence from deep. He's actually someone that needs to be as close to the penalty box as possible to maybe work off a striker or kind of work around knockdowns, something like that. And it's the one sort of element of Liverpool at the minute that I just see as an awkward fit and a little bit of maybe them not being as fluent as they possibly could be. So I would be curious to see how his position changes and evolves during the season, because I don't think realistically it can continue the way it is.
Karthik, Chris talks about awkward fits. So at this point, we have to talk about the Daniel Sturridge conundrum at Liverpool. He's being played in a position that, according to him and according to most, is not his best position. Had some, let's just say, not very well thought out comments in the press where, I mean, he didn't say that he's wouldn't play, you know, in a very elaborate way. He basically said that he didn't really want to play that position. It wasn't the best for him, which wasn't the best idea, I think. I think Klopp handled it well. But what happens with Sturridge now in that position? I think maybe it is early days, but perhaps we're starting to see a realization of Klopp that while Sturridge is an exceptional footballer, probably the most talented footballer on that Liverpool squad, he has to build a system that isn't built around Sturridge because of the fact that he's not available.
It's a conundrum, right? It seems like they have so much attacking talent and a defined set way Jurgen Klopp wants to play, and he expects a certain type of movement, and he expects a certain type of movement off the ball as well, or not just off the ball, but without the ball, without possession, that Daniel Sturridge is just kind of a, in spite of the fact that he's pacey, he's quick, he seems like the kind of guy who could play a center forward position, right, in this setup, similar to Aubameyang at Dortmund, and prior to that, Robert Lewandowski. Obviously, those are two elite players. But Sturridge, when he's fit, is at that level, right? Or has the ability, yep, to score that many goals. But the reality is he does not do the kind of defensive work that you need to do without the ball in advanced areas that Roberto Firmino does, or I presume Danny Ings will do if Danny Ings, when he's fit, is playing that center forward position. So or the kind of work Divock Origi does. Origi works really hard. He may not be the best finisher. We've seen that both in his club career and his international career, but I can see why he's at a club like Liverpool, because his work rate, if he's got good players around him, is just really complimentary and something you can't find in a lot of guys. So Sturridge has to work harder, and he needs to stop shooting off his mouth, quite frankly.
This is while you were talking there, Chris, I was struck by something. So are we talking about Klopp in a way that's maybe unfair? Because perhaps we're talking about, I agree with what Karthik said, that you know, he doesn't put in the defensive shift that a lot of those other players would. But at the end of the day, if you have Sturridge playing as a striker, how relevant is it that he plays those defensive positions? I know in this case, defense means that high pressure, the gegenpress. But perhaps we're being a little unfair to Klopp. What do you think?
I think it reminds me ever so slightly of the Joe Hart situation. Because I think very often when a situation like this occurs, we try to select who is in the right, who is in the wrong, who is the villain, who is the hero, etc. I think actually both sides can have a valid argument. I think Daniel Sturridge is a very talented striker. I don't think he's the best fit for the team at the minute and the style. I actually think Divock Origi is what Sturridge could be if he changed a bit, but he doesn't want to change. And you would argue in changing him, what else do you change about his makeup as a player? So that in itself is something that I think is getting lost in the crossfire. I think it's very difficult as well, because Liverpool fans clearly think very highly of Sturridge. And for a good period when they challenged for the league, when they had Suarez, he was so central to that narrative and that resurgence of the team. So you almost start to think you have to keep him around if you want to achieve anything, mm-hmm. which I think, funnily enough, applies to Hart as well. I'd be tempted, if I was Liverpool, to see if you could sell him. And of course, that could open them up to make the same mistake that Chelsea did when they sold him in the first place. But I just don't see him being a good enough fit now. I think he's a very talented striker. He's unfortunate to have had the injury problems he has. I think he'd work better with a different team, though. And I think the longer you keep him there, the worse it starts to reflect on the team. And equally, the more often you have a result that maybe isn't favourable, the more people, be it media, fans, whatever, will trot out the fact that, why isn't Daniel Sturridge playing? that might not be the answer. Just that one player might not be the answer. It could be a multitude of other reasons that are in no way influenced by Daniel Sturridge's presence.
You know, I agree with you 100%. There is a lot of Liverpool support or fans of the podcast who are listening right now who are yelling, saying, would you sell Sturridge if he was at Newcastle? Would you sell Sturridge if he was at United or City? And the argument that you're making, which I think is entirely valid, is that if you have a manager who's come in, who's trying to build something the way Klopp is, he's trying to build, you know, rise, bring a club out of the ashes, a great club like Liverpool, you need exactly the kind of player that fits your system. And at the end of the day, even though Sturridge is a game changer and is a brilliant footballer, if he doesn't fit the system, at the end of the day, you have to move him on. And I've made this point before, and I agree with you. One last question here, Karthik, about Klopp, and then we talk about Tottenham because we haven't really talked about them. So one thing that I found very interesting about Klopp last year, and I made this mistake myself, was that we talked about Klopp's brilliant run with Liverpool in the Europa League, where they got to the final, and the general analysis we gave was, look what he's doing with a bunch of players that aren't even his own. Imagine what he can do next season. Well, we're here, and to be honest, I'm not as impressed as I was last season. So have we come to this point where we have to start analyzing Klopp? I think we should analyze Klopp more beyond his amazing ability to almost manipulate the media. And he's a very charming person. He's incredibly likable. Even as a Manchester United supporter, you would be a very biased supporter if you didn't like Klopp as a human being. So at what point do we step away from this love for Klopp and analyze him as a manager?
Not after three matches, all of which were away from home, two of them against two of the top three finishers last season. Let's give it some time. I would say you're close on that. I think he certainly doesn't deserve a pass for this season. But when we get to Christmas time, when we get to that run of fixtures, let's see where Liverpool are in the league. I suspect they won't be very high, although I have to say they've gotten off to a bit of a better start than I expected. I thought they would have 3 points at this point, 3 points against Burnley. Yeah. And in fact, they have four. They have four points, three against Arsenal and one against Spurs, which are better results than I thought they'd get in either of those games. So it's a little bit of a long slog, but it still doesn't seem to look right, right? He doesn't have real sense of what his best team is, what the kind of setup he wants between these players. I think that that's a continuing problem, right? And that will continue to be a problem until he makes some decisions about players, including Daniel Sturridge. I think what Chris said earlier is absolutely right, and I think it becomes a problem if you keep him in the team and then he becomes the solution, especially for, and we're going to get into this when we talk about Raheem Sterling and Joe Hart and all this stuff, but especially for lazy English journalists who will always find some sort of solution in an England national team player who isn't playing, or will turn on a manager who isn't playing an England national team player. So it might be best, just for Klopp's own continued love affair with the press and to keep the dressing room harmonious, to ship Sturridge out in the next 3 days.
Karthik, I'm going to stick with you with this Tottenham question. We talked about Tottenham a lot last season about how well they played. This season, they haven't started as well as you and myself and a lot of people expected them to, based on how well they did last season until the last two or three games. So I want to ask you, usually we analyze these things in terms of Tottenham has an advantage over a lot of teams because they have continuity in the team. They haven't lost Harry Kane. They haven't lost, they haven't lost Dele Alli. They haven't lost Eriksen. They haven't lost Pochettino, et cetera, et cetera. They haven't lost their defenders. So therefore they'll come out of the blocks. They'll be strong. But perhaps we're seeing the opposite of that, and which we're also seeing at Leicester, which is that when you don't replenish the squad in a significant way, and you see the teams around you signing the likes of Pogba and Gundogan, etc., does that have an effect of dropping morale on a team that would usually have continuity?
season also. I don't know. I'm a little bit stunned by Spurs' start. That's a good point. Maybe other than Janssen having not signed and Wanyama who slid right in, right, because Dembele's been suspended, they have not made a meaningful signing, and perhaps that's led to some sort of malaise in the squad, and they need to freshen up. Everybody else is fighting for places, fighting for competition at those squads. If anything, Spurs, who already have somewhat of a thin squad, seem to be getting thinner. Ryan Mason on his way out. Right. Bentaleb has been loaned out. And Chadley's going to West Brom, it appears. So, yeah, it's a very, very good question. Pochettino demands in terms of fitness and type of movement and running and pressing, similar. He doesn't quite have the glamour of Klopp because he doesn't have the personality of Klopp, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
But it's a similar type style, and it's been more successful to this point in England than Klopp's has been. Obviously, he has a couple of years on Klopp, but both at Southampton and Spurs, he's been very successful. But you wonder, with such a thin squad and without freshening it up,
and with Champions League.
And with Champions League, correct.
Mm-hmm. Chris, same question to you. I don't really have a different follow-up, really.
I'm just inclined to agree with Kartik. I think, I struggle to add anything to what he said, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know where I stand. I mean, I think with our analysis, it's always biased by how teams are playing. Had they been playing well, we would have argued the continuity point. Now that they're not, there's an easy counterpoint which we can generate. So I guess we just have to keep our eye on the prize here and see how things play out over the next few weeks, which I guess is a caveat for every single team we analyze. So let's go to our next over-analysis here, Chris. Chelsea beating Burnley, very comfortably. There's no doubt that Chelsea looks different in every single way. Costa looks like he cares about his facial hair. Hazard looks like he puts hair gel on his hair again. Like, they look like they actually care this year. So let's again try to analyze what's different about Chelsea. And I have three, they're not completely independent hypotheses. Let me start with that. The first one is, let me pose this to you. Matic and N'Golo Kante in the middle is more conducive to the forward player of, say, Hazard, Costa, etc., than was Matic and Fabregas. Is that why Chelsea has done so well first three games of the season?
I think it's helped. Sean Dyche said something about that. That really Chelsea are a back five. I think he said a front five. Yeah, back five, a front five, and N'Golo Kante covering every other inch. And I think that's actually quite a good way to put it, because what he does, and I don't think it's simply a case of he just runs around a lot, because actually his distance covered numbers were less than Cesc Fabregas last season. It's his ability to make smart decisions. That's what really helps him. His athleticism, his stamina, that's great. It's his ability to read the play and interpret where it's going to end up and then move it quickly. They've had that already at Chelsea with Claude Makélélé, and we already know the story on that one, how influential he was. It can often seem a little bit sensationalist I can't think of a better comparison though than Claude Makélélé. If anything, I think he's a little bit more mobile than Makélélé was. And it just changes the dynamic. It lets people like Eden Hazard, for example, play with more freedom because he doesn't have to track back. And this is the other thing, is I think as we look for kind of that uniformity between players and the team contributing to everything, there are still those players like Eden Hazard who really work best when you don't give them any defensive responsibility. When you push them over the halfway line and say, right, just stay there and we'll get you the ball. And that's what really happened for me against Burnley, was they consistently gave him the ball, which allowed him to initiate attacks, which allowed him to drive with the ball, which is something he does best. I think that there are few, if any, better dribblers in the Premier League than Eden Hazard. And you look at his goal, I think it's typified by that. And so when you can almost keep the players doing what they're supposed to be doing or doing what they do best, I think you're always going to have a recipe for success, realistically. And I think Hazard has kind of alluded to that himself, that, you know, he's best doing that sort of forward-thinking stuff where he's attacking and not defending.
Karthik, the other hypothesis, and again, like I said, this is not completely independent of the first one. Is it simply a difference between Mourinho's style and Conte's style, where Mourinho, both of them can be in a reductionist way, sort of assumed to be defensive managers with their style of football. But there's a huge difference in their style of football. So is it simply a tactical thing or perhaps a personality thing between Mourinho and Conte?
I think it's a personality thing. I think a lot of it had to do with Mourinho grading on that squad last season to the point where the players just simply weren't playing for him at the end.
Right. I totally agree with that. I don't know. I think it's as is true of so many things. It the truth is always somewhere in the middle, isn't it, Karthik? And is there another thing that you think belies why Chelsea is doing so well right now?
Yeah, Conte was the best player in the Premier League last season, and they signed him.
Yeah.
So that makes the shape of the midfield. Look, I mean, we're saying that there's a difference between the Antonio Conte team and the Jose Mourinho team. I think the big difference is swapping Cesc Fabregas, a guy who can't do a lot of running, sits in deep positions, and still plays some beautiful balls, right? Gerrard-esque balls. But a guy who isn't the kind of two-way player Conte is, nowhere near that. You're making that one swap. So I think that in a season where you're talking about teams that are there were obviously other factors, but is that enough to take a team from 10th in the league to fourth or fifth? Yeah, probably. And then you talk about the change of manager. That might be good enough to take a team from fourth or fifth to second or third or first or second. So I think that one signing is a big deal. And then you've got Matic playing a freer role. And this was the freer role actually Mourinho envisioned for Matic at the start of last season, and he wasn't able to deliver on it because Fabregas is so immobile, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, those are great points, and we will keep an eye on that as well. I think the Fabregas, Matic, Conte thing, we have to keep doing this. N'Golo Kanté was the Antonio Conte. The Matic, N'Golo Kanté, and Fabregas thing is something. It makes them gives them a dynamism as well as work rate. It gives them all different options in that center of the park that makes them a very formidable force. And we'll see how Antonio Conte deploys them as the season goes on. Before we continue, I'd like to tell you about our sponsor, SeatGeek. We have some really exciting news to share about our sponsor, SeatGeek, which is that SeatGeek is now the official ticketing partner of Major League Soccer. SeatGeek is working with the league and its teams to introduce a new ticket buying experience that will make it easier for you to buy, sell, share, and access tickets to MLS matches. Next week, the Indianapolis Colts play their final preseason game against the Bengals at Paul Brown Stadium in Cincinnati. Having never been to a preseason game, I was excited to check out this game, and the first place I went to check out tickets was SeatGeek, because I knew those other sites would charge me exorbitant fees at checkout, and I also love how user-friendly the SeatGeek app is. Additionally, SeatGeek does all the price comparison for you by searching multiple ticket sites and ensuring you get the best possible deal. SeatGeek does all the work, and you save time and money. So best of all, our listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, enter promo code WSTPOD, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So go ahead, download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. Chris, let's talk about Crystal Palace's draw with Bournemouth. First thing I wanted to talk about was Josh King. You and I talked about Josh King a while ago on ULF. I thought this goal kind of went underappreciated. That first touch and that finish, exceptionally good. And if Josh King would do enough of this for Bournemouth, you could really see Bournemouth being comfortable and even moving to the, you know, maybe the top 10 of the Premier League. But the problem has been that the likes of Josh King do this in very, very small doses.
Yes, that's essentially the problem of his career, is that he's displayed talent, but it's often been in fits and starts. It was a similar story at Blackburn. He's got a lot of, I think, desirable attributes. He's exceptionally fast. I think he can make intelligent runs when he wants to. it's how often he can put those attributes together to form what is a potentially deadly striker. I liked a lot of what I saw from Bournemouth in the first half. I thought King, Wilson, they did link up well. And but for Steve Mandanda, they could have been maybe two, even three goals up. And I think some of that was facilitated by the fact Crystal Palace are not at a great position right now from a confidence standpoint. You can see there is a nervousness amongst their group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a frustration amongst the supporters as well, which in fairness is entirely justified because they've won. There was a stat floating on Match of the Day last night. I think it is 2 of 22 games in 2016. Now, I can hear 1,000 Newcastle fans screaming that they had a similar run with Pardew towards the end of his tenure. And he has to take a lot of the blame for it. Now, in the second half, they rallied. They were a goal down, though, so it meant that Bournemouth could kind of soak up the pressure and release it deep and compact. And it did frustrate Palace, and you could see they weren't able to find that many great opportunities. And when they did, Artur Boric was pretty inspirational in goal. The goal, it's a difficult one to evaluate because it clearly raised the spirits a little bit, but it felt more like relief than something to actually take away. And, you know, Pardew in general is someone I struggle with, and I think I'd be lying if I didn't say I have a bias towards this, because I think he's someone that is first to take credit when it's going right and last to take blame when things are going wrong. And to me, he's spent a lot of money this summer. That's the other thing to consider. He spent a lot of money on players like Benteke, Townsend, and it has to go right from him. And at this point, it looks like it's lacking just a little bit of understanding. Now, there was a few instances where crosses were coming in and either Wickham and Benteke weren't in the right spot or they weren't gambling into the right areas. That could definitely come with time. My concern if I'm Alan Pardew is time may be in short supply. And that's not to say that Steve Parish will be quick to sack him. I think Parish is giving him every opportunity to succeed. I think there will also come a point where the numbers stack up to the point where you can't do anything but sack him. Because as you said, 2 and 22, it's been a terrible 2016 for Palace. Even the cup run aside, it's been a really terrible year and they can't afford to go down with some of the investments they've made.
Karthik Pardew has some great dance moves that Chris is not giving him credit for. And I have to say that, jokes aside, I feel bad for Pardew in one situation here, which is the latest developing Wilf Zaha situation. Zaha was bought by Palace to give them a dynamism of, you know, they're overly reliant on wingers. We've talked about this before. But Zaha was a slightly different player. Zaha has achieved basically nothing really at Palace. And yet I'm surprised that he wants to move away from Palace because it sounds like he's going to run into the same situation which he had at Manchester United, which is he didn't have enough playing time. He wasn't one of the more important players. And unfortunately for Palace and for Pardew, Zaha's importance to this Palace team was apparent when he came on as a sub in the second half, because that was the moment where Palace started playing well. So what does Pardew do with the Zaha situation?
Oh, I don't know what he does with the Zaha situation. He seems to collect wingers, although, of course, they've sold Bolasie to Everton. Yeah, but they signed Townsend over the summer. I'm not sure. Giggling earlier because, and of course, I put myself on mute after that. Chris hit it spot on. I mean, this is a manager who has never been accountable anywhere he's been. Right. I think about his time even at Reading and at West Ham many moons ago, probably before a lot of our listeners were following this league and this sport. He's always been a guy who stands forward and is quick to toot his own horn, but then when things go badly, it's always someone else's fault or a player, or he's just a guy that I just don't know if players actually respect him when they play for him. Maybe some do. Some guys have chosen to sign with him for a second time, obviously, like Johan Kabay. But I'm not sure the manager, the players will be particularly unhappy if he gets the sack. So
can I say as well, relating to Zaha, Pardew said this week that the 15 million offer was derisory and that, given what Yannick Bolasie went for, he thinks that Zaha is better, and so the offer should be much closer to that.
Zaha is better than Bolasie?
It's crazy.
Any management with these guys? I don't think Zaha is in the same categories Bolasie. I think Bolasie is much better, much more accomplished too in this league.
Now, granted, Will Zaha is a little bit younger than Bolasie, so he has time on his side. I think, though, even if you look at Andros Townsend's numbers last season, he managed to get more goals and assists in, I think it was 13 games for Newcastle from January, than Will Zaha did the entire season. Bolasie had better numbers than him as well during the entire season. I honestly think at this stage in Will Zaha's career, I need to start seeing a little bit of end product from him. I keep hearing about how he's a great player, and for a long time I did admire that talent and thought, you know what, I would love someone like him at my football club. Actually, I think once you get past the tricks and all this kind of stuff that looks great on YouTube, there's not a lot there. He doesn't really deliver nearly as much as you would expect from a winger that's costing even 15 million. I would want a lot more end product from him in that sense. And I found similar watching him on Saturday for Palace when he came on. It was just a situation where you think you've done the first two steps right, but the most important one is the one you keep messing up. And if he's genuinely talking about a player that he thinks is worth 30 million, I don't know what Pardew's saying. I can only assume it's something in training that we're not privy to.
No, I agree with that.
That's really significant, because I think this guy might just be a very good championship player. He was very good for Palace when they were in the championship. He could be Tom Ince, and he could be back in the championship real quickly. Honestly.
Yeah. Good points. When we come back, we'll talk about another 3 to 4 games and update you on the other leagues, results on the other leagues around Europe. So stay tuned for Section 2 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Section 2 of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Chris, let's start with Everton's 1-0 win over Stoke. First of all, I just feel bad for Shay Given. I mean, that being given an own goal, it's you know, it's technically correct, and it's correct by the letter of the law of own goals, I guess, but it's so unfair after he managed to, I guess, flick the PK strike onto the post. It came back and hit him and went to the goal. Just crazy. Another highlight was Crouch in this time saving a goal from with an overhead kick. But what I want to talk to you about was really quickly was Stoke. I feel like this new holding rule in the box is definitely hurting Stoke. And in some ways it's fulfilling the stereotype we have of Stoke, of them being this rough and tumble team. Shawcross last week conceded a penalty. Bardsley this week conceding a penalty. We haven't really talked about this new rule. So what are your thoughts about this new trigger finger rule of holding in the box?
I think it's a good rule. I think what I would say about the penalty yesterday is I wasn't convinced it was a push personally. I think that felt a little bit soft. I can also say that when I watched Stoke last season, they were fairly consistently guilty of holding and things like that and gaining an edge, if you will, in inverted commas. So I think the implementation of the rule is a good idea. I think there maybe just needs a little bit more work on defining its boundaries. And the difficulty is, I think when those kind of set pieces move at such speed, you really do get just a split second to look at something and judge whether it's holding or something like that. I mean, that was the case in the Palace game with the penalty. That was a fairly blatant one, which was easier, whereas you look at the Bardsley one and think, I don't see a really strong push there or anything that I would consider noticeable. If anything, I see him maybe put his hand on his back, but it didn't seem as if he was pushing him at least. So it's something that I think the Kinks will work out. I think much like the situation with Dissent, we'll have to find a common ground or a medium point where it balances itself out so that we're not getting yellow cards just for addressing the referee.
Karthik, the player I think that has been the most improved outside of Hazard and Costa is Kevin Mirallish in the first three games of this season. Another good game, I thought. With Mirallish, we've sometimes had the same complaint we just talked about with Will Zaha, that there's no end product. But I feel like in previous years when he would have turned the ball over, this season he's finding another player. It might not be the most incisive pass, but at least he's retaining possession. He has all those tricks. He can beat a man. And I'm curious what you think it has been the reason for the resurgence of Kevin Mirallish.
Liberation from Roberto Martinez.
I shouldn't have asked. I knew the answer.
He's not truly liberated, because when he goes to the national team,
that's right. Can you imagine? I don't. Did you ever watch
Can
that?
you imagine if Belgium
I
wins the
think.
World Cup, how we're going to react to
Yeah.
this?
Did you ever watch that video where they showed the reaction of Lukaku and Mihalovic finding out that that Martinez had been appointed manager of Belgium?
It was priceless.
It was
Anyone who hasn't
amazing.
seen that YouTube video, you've got to. Yeah, we lose our composure every now and then on the World Soccer Talk pod, but I've really lost it now. You have to look that up. But I think Lukaku, it is a manager change, because I think the director for Martinez was to take guys on, whip balls into the box. There were these crosses that would end up finding defenders, giveaways. I think the director from Koeman is to find a teammate, pull it back if you have to, wait for help, not go a million miles an hour type of thing. And I think it's pretty good. I think it's different. And I also think Morales is coming off a summer where he did not get selected by the former manager Mark Van Bommel, Mark Wilmots. I should mention, by the way, we make fun of Roberto Martinez and people who did have not listened to us during
No,
international
hang
tournaments.
on. You make fun of Roberto
Well, I make fun of Roberto Martinez,
Martinez.
and most of the things I said about him proved to be correct. That I was on an island 2 years ago, and then people generally gradually inhabited the island I had staked out, to the point where we had a overpopulation problem by the end of last season. But he isn't. He's got to be a managerial upgrade over Mark Wilmots for Belgium. And considering the amount of talent Belgium has, and yes, he has worked with Lukaku and Morales before, you think probably Belgium's going to be better than they were under Wilmots. But I think it has a lot to do with the managerial change and change in style, change in directive. It also could be an early season thing. He has to show this consistency. Remember when he signed with Everton many years ago, we saw this spectacular play
Right.
from him, and then it would come and it would go. And there just wasn't ever a consistency, even in the Moyes era, to some of these Everton players.
That's a good point, and I think it will be. I think in a game like this, where they had to take the impetus against Stoke, I think it's okay to give Miralles and Barkley both a free roll like they had. But in games against a tougher opposition, top of the table, I don't know exactly how you fit both of those players into that puzzle alongside Lukaku, from a tactical standpoint. Maybe going to 4-3-3, which they've played a little bit. So yeah, there are lots of questions, but one thing's for sure, Ronald Koeman is one of the best managers to have to fix some of those potential personnel issues. All right, let's talk about Leicester Swans. Another manager we love is Claudio Ranieri. The Tinker Man, quote unquote, that we've been predicting would show up hasn't really shown up yet. And I'm going back to my analysis, Chris, which is that they were unlucky for the last 2 weeks. This week, things fell into place. For example, Vardy's shot strikes the post. Last week would have gone off the post out into row Z. This week goes inside of the post into the goal. The second goal for Wes Morgan, some sloppy defending from Swans, falls right to the feet of Morgan when no one knows where the ball is. He strikes that ball last week. It would have gone nowhere, this time in the goal. So again, with Leicester, I don't think they're doing that much wrong. I don't think they're doing that much differently from last season. And I'm hoping that this will be the start of a run for them.
I think it. I'm not sure if it's down to luck as much as a change in opponent. I think they've had opponents previously in Hull and Arsenal who, between them, one wanted to sit off and soak up the pressure. The other one, I think, had a better defence and wanted to come out a bit. For me, Swansea are a team that I think could be in trouble this season, and I say that because I think they've sold a number of reliable key players, the likes of Ayew, the likes of Williams. And that defensive pairing for me looks like just a disaster waiting to happen. I think there will be good weeks and bad weeks for Leicester. It depends entirely on how the teams approach them. It looks as if they've got Slimani from Sporting Lisbon, or Sporting, excuse me. I didn't offend any Portuguese listeners there.
Well,
He will give
we'll
them
just send
some.
them a copy of the Fort Lauderdale Strikers DVD.
He will give them something a little bit different. Again, I think wait until they've been on a little bit of a bad run, assuming one happens this season. That's when I think you'll see the tinker. I think at the minute, Ranieri sees no need to change because there hasn't really been a great enough sample size of the second season to determine whether they've been found out, in inverted commas.
Karthik, talk to me a little bit more about Swansea then. I mean, Chris has kind of hinted at some points there. You and I were a little bit higher on Swansea in our season preview than Chris was. Have you seen enough from them to convince you that they'll end up somewhere where we thought they would end up?
No. The more I watch them, I think Chris might have been onto something. He might have caught this before we did. I don't like what I'm seeing from them at all. There's just, it just doesn't seem to be any incisive play, any kind of it just doesn't look right. It doesn't feel right. And now we are 3 games into the season, right? So you don't want to overreact to things, but oftentimes you can tell what sides are going to struggle based on their opening fixtures and how they play in them, not just results. And they just look like they're going to struggle. It's going to be a grind to get to 40 points or 42 points, whatever they need this season to stay up, 38 points. They look like they're going to struggle to get results. And that while they still have this ability to control possession at times, they look particularly vulnerable at the back without Ashley Williams there,
right,
who really held it together the last few seasons. And I just don't see Llorente thus far developing into the Michu Bone type scorer. Although I have to say, it's not necessarily Llorente's fault. We've seen him do a lot at bigger clubs than Swansea in the past. I think it's a situation where they just don't have the service in midfield. Sigurdsson has not looked good at all for me in these first 3 games. So I am very concerned about Swansea. I just don't know what the solution is, if they have to sign someone in the midfield or another center back in the next 3 days, or if this is the team they're going with till January and they're going to come out of Christmas, out of the Christmas New Year's period with a, out of the Boxing Day period with a need to really shop in January to stay up. I think it's going to be one or the other. They're either going to have to buy in the next 3 days or do something in January. Otherwise, they're probably – I don't want to say they're probably going to go down, but it's hard for me to pinpoint the teams that are definitely going down at this point because Hull has been better than we thought. And I think Burnley is going to stick around the relegation spots, but in a position to push – as long as Gray doesn't get suspended and they have Vokes fit, because they have two goal scorers, and teams that come up from the championship generally don't have two guys that can score goals like those two can. Right. So Swansea could be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I think your point about signing someone in midfield is valid, because last season, consistently, their best players were the midfielders, and Sigurdsson, who played in that attacking midfielder role, and Ki Sung Yeong, who I thought was very underrated, Leroy Fair, who was also underrated, and this season, they've not, those three players in particular have not clicked yet. So, and then of course losing Ashley Williams, who I think, I'm pretty sure it was him that won the penalty for the, in that Everton 1-0 win. So it must be even hurting even more to see him winning penalties and defending well while Swansea is struggling. Let's talk about a team that didn't struggle this week, Chris. Arsenal beating Watford away from home 3-1. This game was practically over in the first half with Ozil scoring the third goal and having an assist. There's no doubting how good of a footballer Ozil is. I mean, whether you look at the numbers or you look at, you know, whether you actually watch football or you just look at numbers, Ozil is a pretty special player. So, I mean, Wenger came out after the game and said something that just blew my mind, is that he thought Ozil might get, I think he said 20 goals, which is insane to me, because Ozil has never scored more than 8 or 9 goals ever, even during his Real Madrid years. Do you see Ozil as the way he's going to solve this goal scoring conundrum?
No, I don't. To be honest, he's never been that kind of goal scorer. I think the whole Arsenal situation in general is a very complicated one at this precise moment. You see some Arsenal fans even complaining in the wake of that win against Watford, saying it's papering over the cracks. The Arsenal team in general has a lot of potential as it stands right now. I think it needs a little bit of confidence to it. I think it needs a little bit of steel which can come internally, I think, from mental strength. But I'd be very surprised if Ozil became this goal-scoring midfielder. I think you look throughout his career, for me, he's always been someone that creates rather than finishes chances. And that's not a bad thing. I personally believe to have a player like that is important. The more pressing concern or the thing that stops Ozil for me is you look at last season, post-January, it was down tools. It didn't really do much. And I think he needs that consistency. Arsenal need that consistency, but this is an issue we've discussed with that football club for years now, is their lack of consistency. Their ability to go on these fantastic runs and forge a title challenge from sort of November until March and then slip away. It's a fairly infuriating situation, I imagine, as an Arsenal fan. That could be equal parts manager, equal parts player. The difficulty for them this season is that they've got genuine rivals to any attempt to win a Premier League title. So you could argue they've got even more excuse to be inconsistent if they want to be.
Yeah, I should fact check myself there. So he has scored double figures before. Real Madrid, he scored 10 goals twice. Where they Bremen, during his time at Bremen, he scored 11 goals in a season once. But I think in general, the point I was trying to make is still accurate, even though the actual nitty-gritties weren't. Karthik, with Arsenal, what I wanted to ask you was that midfield there with Cazorla and Granit Xhaka. Xhaka, we know is a good footballer. He was very good last season. One of the standout players there. But I guess, do you see that as a good balance? Because that is an area that we have focused in on for Arsenal for many, many seasons. I think the analysis of how whether their forward line is good or their defense is good goes in and out. But the consistent analysis is how strange and uncoordinated they can be in midfield. So now with this Xhaka Cazorla thing that they're trying, is that a good balance in your opinion?
It is if Xhaka plays at the level he did in this game. I think when Aaron Ramsey comes back, they have a decision to make because Ramsey, you're tempted to slide Ramsey back in there. Cazorla is keep in mind his age. He's 32, 33 now, maybe. Maybe he's not that old, but he's in his 30s. So you might need to manage his games. So a rotation in that group of bringing in. Also,
31, yeah.
Ramsey, 31, Elneny is another guy. Obviously,
If
they
you're
have
not, what
a
happened to you're not
central
you're not
midfield.
you don't rate Wilshire anymore? Is that what's going on,
No, I think
Karthik?
that you should play Coughlin, and then you should depend on those other four guys I mentioned. Wilshire is, and I understand he obviously played in this game. It's a guy who's played more minutes for England in the last 15 months than he has for Arsenal. So I. Yeah, I'm not concerned about him. But so here's the point though. These sorts of partnerships always look good for Arsenal in these sorts of games against the Watfords and the Stokes. And we've seen now Arsenal has gone. There used to be this bugaboo about Arsenal having these banana skins against lesser teams away from home. The last two or three seasons, they've actually been very businesslike and gotten these results. It's when they play better teams, as we saw when they played Liverpool at home in the first match of the season, they get these shocking results. They can't beat the better teams in this league consistently enough. And they couldn't even beat Chelsea last season. Think about that. So I think we have to be concerned. They got beat by Liverpool. They should have been beat by Leicester. They were certainly outplayed in that game. So those are the two good teams they've played. This game doesn't change any of my assessment of Arsenal.
We need to wrap up our give you a wrap up on the other leagues here. So we'll start really quickly with Spain. In Spain, in La Liga, Real Madrid and Barcelona kept up their perfect record, while Atletico Madrid were frustrated away from home to newly promoted Leganés, which is a great story because their stadium, much like Bournemouth, is, I think, an 11,000-seater. So I think it's pretty amazing that they are producing that they're in La Liga now and are a great story. In Bundesliga, Bayern walloped Werder Bremen 6-0 with Lewandowski scoring a hat-trick, whereas Dortmund narrowly beat Mainz 2-1. Whereas in Serie A, Inter and Roma both played out draws, while Napoli beat AC Milan 4-2. And as I was discussing before we started recording, the Juventus game was the one that I really enjoyed. It was a It was one that led to Sami Khedira, that was decided by a Sami Khedira goal. Sami Khedira playing in this role, in a more advanced role that was kind of introduced to him during his time with the German national team about 3 or 4 seasons ago, is when he started playing that advanced role, and it's working really, really well now, especially in the absence of Paul Pogba at Juventus. Meanwhile, in France, Monaco won 3-1 at home to mighty PSG, actually. A game that was decided by a brilliant performance by Moutinho and Fabinho. So something that we will be keeping an eye on, kind of defies that analysis that myself and a lot of people try to give, which is that PSG is basically running a one-horse race out in France. When we come back, we'll wrap up the last 3 games of this weekend and call it a night for the World Soccer Talk podcast. So hang in. We'll be back for the part 3 of World Soccer Talk podcast. So at this point, we would usually have a transfer update for you, but given that this is the international week coming up, we're going to do we're going to do a podcast next week where we update you on the transfer window, and it will have shut by that point as well. So let's really quickly tell you, let you know, as you probably do, that West Brom, Middlesbrough, and Southampton, Sunderland played out draws. The first one between West Brom and Middlesbrough being a 0-0, Southampton with a 1-1. We're kind of going to skip those so we can focus heavily in the last 10 or so minutes on the two Manchester clubs. Let's start with the Manchester United game, Karthik. 1-0 win for Manchester United. There's a feeling around Manchester United supporters and apparently the players themselves that the good days are back.
Well, yeah, when you spend as much money as they have, they should be back.
Yeah, but
ironic Marcus Rashford got the winner, right? Because right. We're reading this week about how he'd been discarded, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting what happens to Rashford. I want to talk to you guys about that because he had a breakout season last season. We know season number 2 can be the tricky one for many players, especially Manchester United.
Januzaj,
Kiko Makeda, Fraser Campbell. I think the only one that I can think of off the top of my head that did well in his second season in a long time now was Johnny Evans. I think his second season.
Although Makeda did score a big goal against Chelsea that year that did almost keep the title in Manchester. Well, that was the only thing he did that entire season, that second season. But he did score. But Januzaj, Fraser Campbell, those are great points. I mean, those guys, both second season, just completely fell off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
More or less.
I wonder about what happens with Rashford because I guess the question is, are we going to expect Rashford to be rotated in and out of the squad, or is he now coming down to being, you know, like a super sub? Some United supporters will have you believe that he's the next Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
It's not a bad role for a young – well, it is a bad role probably for a young player, but it's not a bad role for a typical player at a club like Manchester United. I think you've got a situation where you can use Jesse Lingard in that role. You can use – he's a little bit of a different player. You can use Rashford in that role. Mkhitaryan, it appears somehow Juan Mata is hanging on with Jose Mourinho, much to my surprise, and I think the surprise of many people. Mm-hmm. It looks like Mkhitaryan is a bit on the margins and isn't quite up to snuff, which, by the way, I'm not surprised about. There were long periods when he was with Dortmund where he would just fade into these kind of dips that would take weeks and months to come out of, including the entire first half of the 2014-2015 season. So I think there are options. But the fact that he turned to Lingard in the situation with them in a position where they needed a goal, I think, is a very promising sign.
You mean Rashford?
Rashford. Excuse me. Yes.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And Chris, you made some really good points about Rashford on front three, where you talked about the fact that you expect crests and troughs in a young player's career. But I'm curious, like, what do you think is the correct role? What is the right way to handle a 19-year-old at a club like Manchester United where the expectation is ridiculous and unfair for a young player? And at the same time, you have this talented player who somehow, every time he touches the ball, he seems to score every time he's in those situations. So how is Mourinho, or really any manager, supposed to handle a talent like that?
I think you pull and you push. So sometimes, and Paul Scholes talked about this, sometimes you take a young player out just to give them that hunger back, just so they don't feel like they've made it. One of the things I admire most about Rashford is he plays the game with absolutely no fear. He drives at people, and the goal is an influencer, definitely. It's a huge thing. What he did apart from that, though, was commit players, go at them. And I think I've talked about it before on this pod that as far back as 2014, Dario Gralli was talking about the importance for young players to learn how to be good in one-on-one situations and take players on. And that is something that Rashford can do. It's not always the prettiest. It's perhaps not always the most trick-laden, but it gets results. He goes past people. And I think he has the ability to always follow things in. And he's talked about that's one of the key things he was taught was to put himself in those kind of positions because you never know when the ball will come to you. I think in terms of his development, as I said, there will be peaks and troughs. I think you have to almost encourage his lack of fear and then be a support structure when things maybe don't go right so that he can bounce back from them. And then also keep it so he's not maybe buying into his own hype when things start to go really right for him, which they have done so far. He's already scored for England. He's a senior international. He's already scored a few times for Manchester United in big games. That's when you have to be there for them and be like a father figure, which is why I think you look at a lot of players who were precocious talents who were good at a young age. They all talk about the ones that succeed at least. That father-like figure who helped them through that period of their career. And that's what Mourinho needs to be for him. And it's, you could argue it's perhaps a bit of a new and unique space for him to be in because I think I saw a stat floating around saying that's the first teenager to score as a substitute for Mourinho or something along those lines. Regardless, he's not really, in my opinion, been known for working well with young players, especially young strikers. I mean, look at what happened with Lukaku, for example. So that is going to be new ground for him. And I think it's, honestly, I think it's ground he has to traverse. There is no scenario I see where he could maybe even consider selling Rashford on because I think already they see him as a huge part of that club's future because of everything that is associated with young players in Manchester United and producing their own. It is a staple of Manchester United to do that. And I think, again, he has to be part of that future and Mourinho has to do everything he can to include him.
My fear here with Rashford is this. When I look back at the players that didn't make the cut, and I think Januzaj is the best example of this because I think Januzaj arguably had more talent than Rashford does. I think what happened with him between the Moyes and Van Gaal era is that he was asked to focus more on the defensive side, on the being a midfielder, quote unquote, side of his game, and I think it weighed him down to the point that Van Gaal's tactics, which were unless you're exactly unless you're against a person against a defender in a wide area, you do not take a man on one-on-one. So my concern with Rashford simply is this, that as long as Chris, you put it, as long as you allow him to express himself in a creative way, as long as you allow him to enjoy football and don't burden him with the insane tactical side of things for now, I think it's a good thing for Rashford in the long run. And especially for a player at his age, you have to give him the freedom to express himself. And in that sense, I think Rashford is in a position where he basically is the only one competing with Ibrahimovic for that striker position, because that's the position where you have the most creativity. You're allowed to take players on one-on-one in any system, even in Van Gaal's system, that was true. So I think what we're seeing is that finally under Mourinho, we will see Rashford and Ibrahimovic competing for that top position as striker. And it bodes well because they give two different options to Mourinho. And at the same time, one is very young, one is older, so there's experience versus the unpredictability. So I think it bodes well in the long run, caveats aside. Karthik,
The thing I'd say
yeah,
about Januzaj, though, and this is something I have noticed watching him for Sunderland and the brief appearances he's made. I think his fall was self-inflicted. I think his attitude really cost him. And I don't think that same fate will fall Rashford, because I think he's quite mature and has quite a lot of self-awareness to his situation. Watching Yannis already for Sunderland, there are moments where he sort of flounces around, where he's a little bit sort of moody and stroppy, and you can see why David Moyes said that it's up to him to save his career at this point, and it's himself that put in that position. Now, what I would say, I was there when he scored the two goals against Sunderland for Manchester United.
Yeah.
And I remember how gleefully and almost maniacally people were talking about, could he play for England? Is there any way we could get him for it? That, in many ways, typifies one of the big issues with the Premier League, is that we are so quick to crown stars, if only so we can start working on the campaign to destroy them. Mm. And I think Yanezai was a huge example of that. The goals he scored were very good goals. I remember thinking, you know, the guy's really got talent. This is not some YouTube sensation. He's clearly got something about him. But as I said, relating to Rashford, there's peaks and troughs in there. There's going to be days where he can't do it. Mm. And again, the Moy situation likely didn't help. I don't think he was maybe the best coach for him to have at that period. But again, I think to compare the two, I think Yanezai caused a lot of his own problems. And I would hope, for his sake at least, he will realise that at Sunderland. And with all due respect to Sunderland, will realise that his potential should have him playing at a higher stage than that.
Yeah, great point. Karthik, last thing about this game. What struck me in this game is, as first of all, Hull City defended like we thought they would defend. Big credit to Mike Phelan. But what I was thinking in my head was, last season we were posed with this position where United dominated 60-70% possession. But what would happen is, around the 70th minute mark, when United really started to put the pressure on, there would be a breakaway for the other team and they would score on United, and then the heads would drop. That is what was the analysis for last season. And to be honest, it was fairly accurate, because it happened quite a few times. If we remember, the reason United ended up even fifth is because of the number of saves De Gea made. So United were hemorrhaging chances last season. In this game, when United was piling on the pressure, somehow, whether that's based on Hull City's, you know, the fact that Snodgrass wasn't playing that well, etc. The point I'm asking you about is, it felt as though there was a strength in that midfield and that defense that wasn't there last season, because Hull City were not given the chance to really break out of their own midfield positions from those banks of four that they created. And I wonder if it's down to the fact that Fellaini is the one playing in that deeper role versus Carrick or Bastian Schweinsteiger, who you could easily outrun in on a counterattack.
Or Schneiderlin. Yeah, I think... Look, I think Fellaini has played very well these first three games, very, very well. And it seems to be a good foil, particularly in these last two games, for Pogba. I would point out Hull did have a few chances in the second half to score, but they didn't come on breaks, right? They came because of a set piece.
Set pieces, right.
Some sort of decent build-up play. But Mike Phelan has done just a phenomenal job, a guy that obviously everybody around Manchester United knows very well. I think they're probably very happy for him, how well he's doing at Hull. Hopefully he'll get that job permanently. I can't see them finding a better manager than him right now, considering how this team seems to have responded to him. I mean, even yesterday, with the chips down, it took this late Rashford winner, and they looked the part. Hull didn't look like a team. They only looked like a team hanging on in the last 7 to 10 minutes.
Right.
Up until about minute 80 or 82, they didn't look like a team hanging on. They looked like a team that could get maybe steal the results, steal the goals. So I was pleased with what I saw from them, and Chris had made this point on the podcast several seasons ago when Spurs sold Tom Huddleston to Hull, a decision at the time under Andre Villas-Boas that we didn't quite understand why that decision was made. Mm-hmm. And I've seen in these first three games Huddleston back to his best. He's controlling the tempo of games. He's a two-way player. He's got a great range of passing, and he can even launch a rocket from outside the area. So I really liked what we saw from Hull. But yes, back to your question. I know I diverted there from it. I think Fellaini is a keeper now for United. There's still rumors he'll be sold in the next 3 days. I don't see how they do that at this point. I don't think he gives you something completely different than Carrick and Schneiderlin. I think certainly you want to play Carrick at times because of his distribution, his ability to keep the ball moving, particularly maybe in Europe. You want to play Carrick. Although they're in Europa League, right? Not in Champions League. But,
Thanks a lot, Carter.
No, I did Champions League. I wasn't. It just occurred to me that bit of analysis.
Sure, it did.
But still, you might want to play Carrick in Europe and against some of the top Premier League teams when you play in Arsenal, when you play at Chelsea. But I think you keep Fellaini, and I think you keep him in this team. It seems he and Pogba have already developed a level of understanding, at least in positioning, that it may take some time for Carrick and Schneiderlin to develop with Pogba. And we know Schweinsteiger is not part of the plans.
Right.
So that's not even a consideration, right?
Let's move ahead to the last game that we're going to discuss today, which is Manchester City's win against West Ham. Sterling, Chris, with another good game. First game week review of World Soccer Talk, we talked about how that Pep Guardiola builds this system that allows the ball to be brought to the final third, and then those players have creativity, and perhaps that's the reason Sterling is doing well. Last week, we talked about the role of De Bruyne with Karthik in that 4-3-3 formation. I want to talk to you about the Fernandinho role, because what Guardiola has done, one summary I would have of Guardiola's time as manager as a whole, is he has brought back the importance of the holding midfielder to the front of football, to the point that I think now when people talk about building systems, etc., they talk about the holding midfielder as the crucial point of that system, whether we're talking about Busquets or Xabi Alonso, etc., etc. Do you think Fernandinho is a good enough player to play that role for Pep Guardiola?
I'd say so. I don't think he's perfect. I think his yellow card showed that he was a little bit caught up in the initial tempo and how quickly the game started. I think Guardiola's sort of inclusion of a deep line midfielder, that shouldn't come as a surprise because it's a role he played himself. Mm-hmm, and I think... Right. It's a role that kind of faded out as he got a little bit older himself, and it actually stopped a few teams trying to sign him when he was available on a free transfer from Barcelona. I think realistically if we compare him to the last sort of deep line playmaker that Guardiola had in Xabi Alonso, there are certainly ways I think he's better than Xabi Alonso.
Like what?
I think his ability to cover the ground, I think his right. tackling, even though I've just critiqued it, is overall a little bit better. Mm-hmm. His passing, of course, is not.
Few people can pass better than Xabi Alonso, though.
Exactly. It's like saying you're not as good an entertainer as Prince. There's no shame in that. I think he will be able to sort of tick enough of the boxes, if you will, or provide enough of the attributes that Guardiola would like. I mean, this is the other thing as well. Gundogan is still to play for this team. Right. And I actually, funny enough, forgot about that today when I was watching it, and only realized kind of halfway through when I was scanning through the squad list that he can come in. And you can argue is the perfect example of what he wants from that position. So that competition could spur Fernandinho on, because I think there is a quality there. I think it would be unfair if we just started dismantling every player that wasn't there when Guardiola started, because actually I think Fernandinho has a lot of talent and has shown that during his City career. So the idea of him being reinvented, so to speak, is maybe a little bit too far.
Karthik, you were pretty skeptical of City's chances in the Premier League and this season as a whole. I think some of that comes from the fact that I think you're setting yourself up not to get called out on social media sometimes, which I feel bad for you, because I saw the Pro Rel stuff today that you were dealing with. So I have sympathy
because
for
the Pro Rel. I'm just going to take a little point of personal privilege here, and I think everybody who listens to this podcast will find this hilarious. The Pro Rel people in the United States were holding up RB Leipzig as an example of.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's how it all started. I'm like, wait a second. You guys always decry bought promotion. Orlando City bought promotion. Minnesota United bought promotion. Portland Timbers bought promotion. And you're holding up this team because they were about to kick off Red Bull Leipzig, or RB Leipzig, excuse me. There, mm-hmm. And these guys were talking This team has been promoted for the first time
Yikes.
to Bundesliga 1 in their history. And they've gotten 4 promotions or whatever. They were just buying the narrative, reading the narrative, taking the narrative, not realizing this team is the most controversial subject in German football in some time. How they've just essentially bought their way up the divisions.
Right.
And could eventually buy their way, because they have the kind of resources that community-based clubs in Germany don't have, in a time when German clubs are having to sell players to Premier League clubs. Even big clubs, corporate clubs like Bayer Leverkusen are selling players. I mean, Leipzig could be in the top 4 in a couple of seasons. This team that was an amateur fifth division team a few years ago. So it's that's how that whole thing started. I think
people,
European football fans that listen to this podcast will take my side on it, quite frankly.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a perfect example of how a lot of those pro-rel guys just don't Google stuff before they send out a hateful tweet.
Yeah, they don't really watch football, because if they knew anything about football or the global game, other than their ideological talking points, they would know Leipzig is not definitely not the team you want to champion. Champion Bournemouth, but don't champion Leipzig.
Right. Agreed. So Karthik, yeah, coming back to this, I have sympathy for you in that sense, but have you seen more of – are you a little more convinced on City, or are you still going to claim that they're going to finish sixth, which is – you're literally the only person – oh, I thought you said sixth, so fifth or sixth. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I assume Arsenal is going to come on at some point. But right now, I think City are one of the top three teams in the league, and certainly the
– I mean, literally, yeah.
Well, yeah, no, but they are one of the top three teams in the way they're playing. I would say the top – The teams that have played the best this season have been the teams at the top of the table. I'm not Everton. Everton is ahead of Hull, I believe, but Hull has played better than them. So the top four teams have been these three, the three big guns, and then Hull City, who took United all the way to the death yesterday. So that would be they've been good. I think what we're finding is that Nolito and Sterling are fitting in particularly well in Pep's system, and that's important. That's really important. I think you've also got a possibility also of doing some different things, as we saw with Samir Nasri today, playing him out wide, playing him in the Nolito role, playing him as a second striker maybe at times. The big question will come when injuries strike, Aguero injury or potential suspension now. He could be suspended for the next 3 games because of violent conduct. I'm not sure Aguero affects the movement of this team as much as if you took Silva or De Bruyne out. Now, both those guys have had injuries in recent years. Silva is over the age of 30. If you take Silva out and replace him with Nasri in this particular system, does it work the same way? Because we saw under Pellegrini, not last season, but the first season Pellegrini was at City, that if you took Silva out of the team and put Nasri in instead, it didn't really make a difference, right? That they were both very good, and they both could play in that system kind of at an equal level. Silva is just a more what's the word I look for? He's just a more reliable person, right? He's not a head case like Nasri. But in terms of creativity and ability on the ball in tight spaces, they both have something that most players in the English game don't have. But the question is, when you have to start swapping guys out, when Sterling gets swapped out for Sané, do you have a drop-off? When Nolito gets swapped out for whoever that replacement player is, do you have a drop-off? Gundogan, will he adjust to the Premier League? Will he be fit enough to play enough games so that Fernandinho doesn't have to play 50 games again? Because Fernandinho, last season, City went all the way to the final of the League Cup. City went all the way to the semifinals of the Champions League. Fernandinho had to play basically every match. He's that player. Chris just talked about him. He's that one kind of linchpin player in the team. You could rotate, swap other guys out, including Aguero. You could swap him out for Boney or Iheanacho in certain games, but you could never take Fernandinho out of the team. If Gundogan is not fit, and we know Fernando can't do the job in this system, he's a pure defensive midfielder. You really worry if this thing is going to the consistency is going to continue. But one other point, I think on the back line, John Stones played very well. He didn't play
Chris,
this well.
Chris, are you okay? Are those fireworks going off in your room?
They're not. Sorry, it's just my chair.
All right.
I would just real quickly say John Stones is looking like – no one's going to say a £47 million signing is the signing of the season, but it's looking like a really, really, really good signing considering how many people scratch your head at the cost thus far. It just is – he's a better center half. So even if he makes defensive mistakes, it seems like he's the kind of player who just fits naturally into a Pep system, and a type of player Pep needed and was going to go ahead and overpay to get, because he didn't have that he didn't inherit that kind of player on the back line at City, and he needed that guy. And it seems like, at least for a system, money well spent.
Yeah. Three years ago, guys, United and City started off the season incredibly well. It included an 8-2 win over Arsenal for United, a 5-1, I think, win over Tottenham. And then United played City and lost 6-1. Next game, United plays Manchester City. It's going to be a huge one in 2 weeks. Two very good teams, two very different teams, and probably, as we've mentioned, all agreed on in general.
That was actually 5 years ago, I would mention.
Because it's 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's how much time flies.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, because that was the last time, I think, that the Manchester teams both came out of the gates so quickly, was the 2011-12 season. And keep in mind that season, now Chelsea started equally quickly this season. Keep in mind that season, there was a 19-point gap between second-place Manchester United and third-place Arsenal. Could these two teams run away and hide again this season? I don't think so, but that's the precedent. Since you mentioned that season, 19-point gap between second and third.
I guess time all runs together when you're doing a pointless PhD. Next week, we'll be back to talk about the transfer window. We'll be wrapping up our thoughts on that, as well as previewing the Manchester Derby and talking about the other games. So make sure you tune in for that. We have a lot coming up for you. And on behalf of everyone here at World Soccer Talk, myself, Nipun Chopra, Chris Henaj, Karthik, take us away.
Unless you're Alan Pardew, you're enjoying your football during this international break.